And if we can, can we start at the very beginning, and the very beginning being a personal question, where is Kensington, Georgia? That's where you were born.
That's up near Chickamauga, Georgia.
I see.
I was born at Kensington. That's 9 miles from Chickamauga. But I was actually raised at Chickamauga. That's near the Chickamauga Park. You've heard of that.
Right.
During the war, and I was raised up there till I came to Cedartown High School in 1920. Came down there in 1926 and went to high school in 1927, and was signed up at the high school.
Which high school was that?
What?
Which high school, sir?
The Cedartown High School.
Sorry.
And I was signed up we went down that day to practice. And the we had a town team, you know, and the city catcher was down there. So Charlie Knowles, and I said, Charlie, I says, who's that fellow? That, well, we had a left-hand pitcher from Anniston, Alabama on our team, and boy, he could throw. And that's the reason we had a team. Usually high schools don't have a baseball team, you know. It's just, you know, it's too much to do. And we had this boy, and he was so good. And, of course, I pitched some, but I played first base most of the time. And I asked Charlie Knowles, I says, who is this fellow over here? And he says, that's Eddie Goostree, a scout for Detroit. Well, that didn't bother me one bit in the world. I didn't know A from Z. But anyway, he asked me about a ball, and he wanted to see Frank Chilton throw some. Say he didn't know a thing more about me now, and he threw, and I told Charlie, I said, see if you can get that ball, I'd like to throw. Well, the first thing that started, though, he sent a boy uptown to get a ball, and we told him where to go, so, and he told him, gave him a $5 bill, I believe. And he said, go up there and get a ball. And he came back and told Mr. Goostree, says, they didn't have any $5 balls. And he told him, well, it cost about $2.50. So he went back and came back with the ball. And see, high school like that, we don't have any money. And I wanted to get a hold of that new ball and throw it myself, you know. It's pretty good. And after that, he was talking to Frank. He got through throwing, and Charlie had his mitt down there. He was a catcher. He went to Decatur in the 3-I League the same year that I went to Edmondville. But he didn't want to stay away from home.
Decatur, Illinois.
Yeah, right. And so we were catching, and he asked Frank, says, who is this kid? He says, he's a first baseman on the high school team. And it turned out that he signed me instead of Frank. That's how I got started in baseball. I went up to Detroit and visited Detroit. In 1927, I guess it was. And talked to Mr. Navin. He owned the ball club. And I went up there, and I'd never been away from home in my life. My brother put me on in an upper berth on a train going to Detroit in Chattanooga. My brother was a real good baseball player. In fact, he's a better ball player than I was. But he got an education, and I didn't. I got up there and got off the train, of course, and found out how to get to the hotel, the Statler Hotel, and I went in the hotel and rested, you know, real country. I just didn't know anything. I mean, I was a country boy, sure enough. And I asked him about the ballpark. And after I put my things in the room, I hurried down because I had to get to the park, see. So I came down and asked him about where the ballpark. He says, well, this is, you go up to such and such a street. And told him the way to go. And turn to the right, and says, you go down that street till you hit Trumbull Boulevard. And he says, that's, yeah, the ballpark is right there. So I went, walked and walked and walked. I kind of thought the ballpark would be out in the country like here, you know. And I was kidding. I said, well, I better eat breakfast. So I stopped in a place to eat breakfast. And I don't think I'd ever eaten a cafe or anything very much. And I went in and ordered. The whole thing I needed to order was ham and eggs, so I ordered ham and eggs. And he brought out, I remember he brought out French fried potatoes. And I told him, I says, I didn't order French fried potatoes. He says, we serve potatoes with all breakfast. So I see, I was learning. And so I went on down and I walked. I walked a long ways. And finally come to Trumbull Boulevard. And over here, I was walking the road in Trumbull Boulevard going there. And right in that corner there was a stucco building. I thought, well, my goodness, there's something wrong here someplace. So I inquired, and finally they said, that's Navin Field. So I got into Navin Field. That was the ballpark. And I stayed up there about a week and through batting practice and just listened, just tell you the truth about it. They had a ball, had some great ball players back that time. They had Harry Howland, you remember him?
I know the name, certainly.
And Earl Whitehill, mm-hmm. and George Uhle, a pitcher, Uhle, right. U-H-L-E, yep. He was great.
Right.
And
Charlie Gehringer would have been at second base at that time, certainly.
Charlie Gehringer, yeah, right. That's because I mean, that you're thinking of him. Because I guess he's probably the greatest, I don't say, well, he's the greatest second baseman I ever saw. And I stayed around there till, listen, we played Washington first, I think. And then we played the Yankees. And Ruth and them came in, you know. And, of course, I was just, anxious to see Babe Ruth, you know.
That was the year, wasn't it? 1927, that was the year.
27,
right.
Yeah. And while we was at batting practice, he sat on our bench, you know. He cut up all the time. He's a lot of fun. And he'd tell stories and, you know, listen in the dugout like it. I didn't open my mouth. And I did pitch for Detroit, and he hit a home run off me in the Navin Field. And I said, that's the only home run that I was ever really proud of. I was proud that we get one off. I threw some more, too. But I stayed there till the last day. And Mr. Navin wanted me to come up and talk to him. So they were going to Boston. And he came in from the field that day. And I waited till George Moriarty. Gosh, this morning I thought of that. He was the manager. And I waited for him to get out of the shower before I went in. I did come back behind him, you know. And some fellow had gotten in the clubhouse, and he was drunk, and walked up to George and said something to him, and George hauled loose and said something to him, and I think took a swing at him. And he took a swing at him and missed him and fell down and broke his collarbone. And I said, gosh almighty, I said, this is a rough game. I didn't know whether I wanted to play ball then or not. But anyway, I wanted to talk to Mr. Navin the next day, and we talked about playing. I said, I didn't want to see you down high school. Of course, I was interested in football then. I wasn't interested in much interested in baseball. But I did have a good arm. And I said, now, I want to go to school. And he says, well, can't you, what would it cost you to go to school? I said, well, now, I can go to school. I said, I don't have the money, but I can go to school on a football scholarship. In fact, I'd already told Tech I would come to Tech on a football scholarship. Which I did. I went over to state about a month or 2 months. And when I finally signed with Detroit, though, I came home, of course, went up to spring training next year with Edmondville, Indiana. That's my first 2 years with Edmondville. That was 28 and 29. And I had a fairly good year the first year, and the second year I had a real good year. And I went up to the big club and joined them in Boston in 19 and 29, the last month of the season. And stayed there, of course, that to the end of the season. Then went back in 30, and I stayed all of 30. In 31, I developed a sore arm. I had a little trouble with my arm. And they asked me, says, where can you... what do you think you ought to do? I says, if I could go someplace where it's real hot and pitch, I says, I think it'd help my arm as much as anything. I like hot weather. I loved hot weather. And he says, well, we just send you to Beaumont. That's one of their farm clubs, you know. So they sent me to Beaumont down about the half. They said, want me to get down there and pitch a game or two before the half was over, because Beaumont had a chance to win the half. And I came by home, of course. I lived at Cedartown at that time. I came by home and I stayed a day or two at home. Day or two. So I didn't get down there as early as they wanted me to get down there. But in fact, I finally went down there and didn't do very good to start off with. And I went out in that hot sun every morning to take batting practice. And I had a colored boy that pitched batting practice to me. And I just stayed in the sun all the time. And finally, I pitched a game and beat this club. I can't think of them all of them now. But anyway, beat this club 3-2. And felt like I had my arm and come around a little bit, you know. So I ended up and won 11 and lost 3. I lost 1-1, 2-1, 1-3-2. And... that was the year that Dizzy Dean was at Houston. And they were playing Houston, see, and they finally tied Houston for the first half. So during the latter part of the season, the last month of the season, they let 3 games count for the playoff in the regular season, you know. So I pitched against Dean and beat him 2-0. And that's the only game they beat us 3-2. Yeah, I mean, 3-2. They won 3, and we 2-1. And that's the only game we won. And, of course, I came home and went back to Detroit and stayed there till 19. And 33, I guess it was, they traded me to the White Sox. I wasn't going too good. I went over to the White Sox and did fairly good. Muddy Rule, the old pitcher for the Washington Club, you remember him?
I know the name.
He was a catcher over there, and he was real smart. And I think maybe he hit me a good little bit. But they finally traded me to the middle of 36, I guess it was. They traded me to the White Sox.
32. You mean Cleveland in 37?
Cleveland.
Right. That was quite a pitching staff.
I'm getting mixed up there a little bit. So I went to, they let me go to Kansas City for a half a season, the way it was. And at the end of that season, I did fairly good. And at the end of that season, what actually happened, the Detroit Club traded me to the White Sox for Vic Frazier.
Oh, another fine pitcher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I stayed to go to the White Sox till 36. Then they sent me to Kansas City for a half a season.
Okay.
And at the end of that season, they traded me to the Milwaukee Club in 3I League, International League, and for a third baseman, great third base, played third base for them a long time. I can't think of his name.
For the White Sox?
No, Cleveland.
No, I don't. I can't come up with a name.
Anyway, they traded me for this third baseman, and he stayed up Cleveland a long time. I'd say it's about 10 years.
Not Keltner, was it? Not Ken Keltner, was it?
No.
I don't know who it was then. Bob Johnson?
No.
Hmm.
Maybe a right-hand hitter. But anyway, the next year, I came home and let's see, well, it's not Cleveland. I didn't win but one, about three. I won three and lost two, I believe, at Cleveland. And of course, when they traded me to Milwaukee, I was about ready to quit. I had the farm then and bought this farm in 1933. And they wrote me a letter and wanted me to come up and sign. I told them that I was going to quit. I wasn't going to play ball anymore. And finally, the man that owned the club was a lawyer up there, and he owned the club, and he wrote me a letter and told me if I would report to them at Hot Springs, Arkansas, which they trained, that if I got out there and didn't want to stay, that they'd pay my way back home. So I told my wife, I said, I haven't got anything to lose, so I'm gonna go out there. I want to go to Hot Springs anyway. And so I went out there, and we finally got together on a contract. He wanted to give me so much, and for $40,000, as if I was sold to a major league club, which I thought it was silly because I didn't think I was going up. I thought, you know, just about. Well, I didn't think I'd ever get back to Major Leagues again, just to be frank with you. And I finally went out there and signed up. He signed on the sign me, and I says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I says, I'll sign a contract for $700 a month. And I know what I'm going to get. I know how I'm going to come out financially, which wasn't much money, but back then that wasn't too bad. Could make a living. And I worked real hard. I worked hard as heck during spring training, and finally we opened the season in Toledo, and I got beat, knocked me out of the box in about the fourth inning. And of course that disheartened me a lot. I thought, well, I'm not going in. I haven't learned anything. But anyway, I went on into Indianapolis Columbus, and beat Columbus 3-2. And I thought, well, by golly, I've earned a little bit. I kind of felt like I really had made a little progress. And then we went into Indianapolis and pitched the game and got beat 4-3 in 10 innings, which I didn't think was too bad. But like DeRocher always says, if you get beat, you get beat. If you get beat 1-0, you get beat. He just it's either win or lose with you. That's the way he felt about it. And I left there, and we went to Milwaukee, and I pitched against Louisville, and I beat them 10-0 and struck out 10, and struck out Pee Wee Reese. That was his first year. Struck out Pee Wee Reese four times. And it's a little story to that. I'll get to that later on. And I stayed at a little old hotel there, Warwick Hotel, I believe it was. And that night I went back to that hotel, and I knew as well as anything in the world. I said, well, by golly, I have finally become a pitcher. I knew it. It's just as plain as anything in the world.
Was it just all sorts of things sort of fell together for you? That all of a sudden it made sense?
Joe Becker was a catcher, and he had a little experience, and he hit me a lot. And I started changing the speed of the ball. And I started changing the speed of the ball, and I guess me actually throwing more strikes. And won that game, and I finally ended up winning 22 and lost 6, I believe it was, that year. Now, that's not, I don't know what that's, it tells you in that right up there.
On the next page. The is 23-1.
23-1. It could have been 23.
Well, either way, it was a.
But anyway, season. I was voted the most valuable player in the league that year, and so about a month before the season was over, a manager came to me and told me that if we got a chance to send you to the back to the major leagues. He says you can either go to Boston or you can go to Brooklyn. He says we give you the privilege, you name the club, and he says I'll put in a word here for you. He says I think Ruth is going to be the manager of the Brooklyn club next year.
Was it the owner of the Milwaukee
team? No, that was the manager.
I'm sorry, the manager of the Milwaukee team, and that was his name was.
Funny.
Okay.
That's.
It'll probably come back later.
That's age for you.
Well, I got to admit, I was real curious as to where the idea came that Ruth was going to be the manager of the Dodgers.
No, I was the manager of the Milwaukee club. And so they sold me to Brooklyn. Sold me for $40,000 and three players. And didn't give me any of that. I didn't get any money either. And the end of the season, owner of the club came to me and told me, says, which of you want to do something for you? And says, we either give you a car or a John Deere tractor. And I had this farm. I says, my gosh, I'd take a dad and lame tractor. And I got a tractor and I've got a picture someplace here. Me, I didn't think it's actually on the wall. Me on that tractor. And that started me to farm it. So I went to course to the Dodgers and next spring and did this see that would have been what I've been 39,
right? 39. What was your reaction when you found out that Leo DeRocher was going to be the manager instead of Babe Ruth?
Well, it didn't make that much difference to me because I tell you I was just happy to be going back to the major leagues. And I don't think it ever made that way. And going, in fact, as far as going and playing for DeRocher's concern, I think he hit me. But he put a little fire under me, to tell you the truth about it. You know, DeRocher was a smart boy. He had as good a mind as anybody has, as far as baseball or nearly anything else. And he put a little, taught me to be a little mean as a pitcher. Be frank, that's what he did. I know a lot of times I'd knock somebody down, you know, and come in my locker, and he'd have me $200 or $300 laying up top of my locker just for knocking somebody down, you know. And I finally found out, by gosh, it paid off.
Yes.
So I think I was kind of, I had that kind of a day. In fact, in some write-up not too long ago someplace, it might be in there, but... who was it? Oh, yeah, I pitched, knocked DiMaggio down in World Series 1941, fifth game.
Pete Reiser talked about that a lot. Is it Pete Reiser or Pete Reiser?
Both of them.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, they both came up. But that's what I wanted to get to tell you. When Reese came to the Brooklyn Club in 40, I went up in 39, he came the next year, 41. No, 40. And that's the first thing he said to me. He says, I never will forgive you for tracking me up four times. Because I never have forgotten. Great kid. In fact, that's two of the finest ball players I ever saw come up together. He and Reiser. Reiser, great.
Branch Rickey says that Reiser was the best ball player he ever saw.
Probably was.
He tells a he thought the world of you. I've read some of the things that he wrote. Reiser, he thought absolutely the world of you. He said that if he had to sculpt a statue of a pitcher, it would be Whitlow Wyatt in terms of form, grace, and style. He thought you were just great.
Yeah, I read that someplace. Yeah. I don't know where I read it.
Yeah. He also recalled that about Joe DiMaggio. He says DiMaggio said you were the meanest person he ever saw in his life.
He said, I read that someplace the other day. Now, this hadn't been long ago. Something on where I read it. It might be in there. That DiMaggio said that says he's the nicest fellow I ever saw, but says, boy, he'll knock your head off in the boat. And that day that I knocked him down, I didn't want to knock him down, actually, because tell you the truth about it, I was getting him out. And they say, when you're getting a fellow out, so let's...
Let it lie.
Sleeping dog lie, you know. And don't wake him up. Particularly a good ball player. Now, some player that wasn't too good, you might not wake him up. You might hurt him, which you would. But anyway, after the game was over, it's kind of funny. I went into the clubhouse to tell their clubhouse man, Johnny somebody, I can't remember those names now, where to send my truck to. And when I went in there, I went through the back door, and the first fellow I saw, I walked into the Maggio. This was in the visiting clubhouse. And he walked up and shook hands with me and says, congratulations, and says, you deserve but luck. And I did. I pitched one heck of a game.
Yes.
I won the first game 3-2
right.
That I pitched.
9 hits and 2 errors behind you. That was a tough one to win.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the second game.
Second game, I pitched great.
Great, yeah.
It just, I forget now how that turned out. But anyway, I scored the only run in that game that day. Double and scored a run, I think. And that's the reason DiMaggio said that. He said, and Dickie did the same thing. I shook hands with Dickie, and he congratulated me and said, you deserve a better luck. And so that's, I've learned that you're not some great player down like that. He forgets it.
Did pitchers at that time literally throw at players, or were they just trying to move them back from the plate?
I never did throw at a fellow to hit him. I hit some, but I didn't throw at him. Hit him at the time. When I tried to pitch.
If they were trying to hit a batter, would they throw behind the head?
That's the worst place you can throw. I mean, you might
because
do some
the natural reaction is to.
Because it's your actions. You're going to go backwards.
Yeah.
And I've been throwing at myself. And there's a writer for the New York Times told me, I believe the New York Times told me later, he says, which says you could pitch high inside to hitters better than anybody I ever saw. He was an old writer, too. Oh, Roscoe McGowan. Does that ring a bell?
I know the name, right.
Roscoe McGowan. Great fellow. I mean, nice fellow. High type fellow. And, he told me that. But
well, you had a good year in 1939 with the Dodgers, and you had a better year in 40 and even a better year in 1941.
Well, in 39, first year, I won 8 straight games. 4 of them were shutouts. And I was pitching in Cincinnati against Cincinnati Club. And about the 4th or 15th, and I run into Lonnie Fry at first base. Told my knee all to pieces. I won 11 and lost 3 that year. If that hadn't happened to me, I don't know what kind of a year I'd have. There's no telling. Well, of course, something else could have happened too, as far as that's concerned. But I ended up 11-3, I believe, that year. Have you got those statistics?
I've got some statistics here. It says 8-3 here, but I don't know. Yeah, all it says.
Well, that could have been right.
It says you had. Because
I won the first 8 games. I know that.
You had a good ERA of 2.31.
Yeah.
That's first rate.
And what did you say I won the second year? I've forgotten.
Well, you didn't win quite as many as 15 and 14, but you led the league in shutouts.
That's right. 15, 14, that's right.
And you led the league in shutouts that year with 5 of them.
Yeah. And I think the next year, didn't it say 41? Did I have 7 shutouts?
Yes. Led the league again.
Yeah, I had 7 shutouts.
Yeah, some people have said that you were the best pitcher in the National League that year. Nobody even close.
Well, I didn't know then, that good, but that was good, I guess. And
42, 19 and 7. And then 14 and 5 in 1943. All great years.
Yeah. But I had those years that I had with the Dodgers, had those now. I'd made pretty good money, wouldn't I?
Yes.
Somebody wrote me not long ago something. I get a lot of fan mail. I get more fan mail now than I played. And some fellow the other day sent me a lawyer up in New York sent me 60 8x10 pictures to sign. 60. And sent me 50 cards. Those, you know what I'm talking about, the small cards. 50 of those and 24 balls.
Was he offering you anything for that?
He's the first man that's ever offered me anything for signing anything. And two fellows in Atlanta that I know are real good friends, and they do that. They deal in this business. And in fact, well, I'm supposed to come out here yesterday, but I told him to wait till after I got, had my operation before we came.
Well, I collect autographs, too. I've asked a number of players to sign
I believe he gave me $60 for the pictures. And he gave me $20 for the balls, which I found out since then from these fellas that wasn't anything really. But that's the first time I ever had any money given to me for signing anything. I put a letter in a picture in the mail this morning. I have pictures every day they send me. Gosh, it gets to tell you the truth about it, gets where it kind of bothers you a little bit after. Some of them will send things to you and not give you any envelope, send them back in and things like that, you know. And you have to put stamps on them, which is all right.
Well, when I do it, I always put in a nice little letter and offer to pay if there's anything that the ball player wants, and there's a card and a self-addressed stamped envelope.
Well, I get some real nice letters. And when I do, I write them a letter.
Oh.
It's unusual, you know.
Yes, it is.
I write them a letter. And I hear from some fellows 2 or 3 times, you know, write them, then they write me back. And I always felt like if you made somebody happy, that's life. That's a good part of life. You just make somebody happy all the time.
I got a card yesterday from somebody you know, Enos Slaughter.
Enos Slaughter?
Right. He wrote me back. Let's talk a little bit about 1941 and 1942. Those were quite
the years. In 1941, I pitched a game against the Cardinals in St. Louis. We went in there to play, and I believe we were a game and a half ahead of the Cardinals. And we had a meeting, and DeRocha says, Witt says, how you feeling? I says, well, I had 2 days rest. I says, I feel like if I had another day's rest, it'd help me because I felt like I was a little bit tired. And he says, well, we'll just let Fitzsimmons pitch today. Says he's had 3 days rest. So he pitched, and I kidded Fitzsimmons about that game. I said, he didn't pitch that game today. I says, you talked your way through that game. He beat him 4-3 or something like that. Low score, and he did. Boy, he was a boy. He was a competitor now. There was one. And so I had to pitch the next day. So I started that game, and I didn't have nothing. I just fiddled around, and I made good pitches, you know. I didn't have good stuff. And I thought, well, gosh, I won't last long in this game. I fooled around to the butt. I was that kind of a pitcher, though. If you beat me, you had to beat me the first 1 or 2 or 3 innings. If I ever went past in there, my brother, I pitched 9 innings. I think that 41, I believe I pitched 27 complete games. I'm not sure about that.
23 out of 38 that you pitched in.
And in about the 4th inning, somebody hit a double off of me. And let's see, who came up and hit a ball to the shortstop. Pee-wee fielded the ball, but the fellow on second base tried to go to third, and Pee-wee picked him off third. No, he threw the ball away, and the ball liked about that much going into the dugout, which would have been an automatic run, you know. And I had 2 men on base and nobody out. And for just some reason or other, my stuff just came to me just like that. And I struck out the catcher.
For the Cardinals?
Uh,
Walker Cooper?
No, it's an old catcher that went from our club over there. Mancuso.
Gus Mancuso.
And then I struck out the pitcher, Cooper. And then the third baseman came up, a left-hand hitter. Kind of a pesky hitter. And he had, I threw him a slow curve, and he had grounded out to first base. I got out of that inning, and I had the most stuff in a ball game that I've ever had in my life after that. Got out of that inning without a run and beat him 1-0. And I believe that's the best game that I ever pitched in my life without saying, looking back, you know, a pitcher makes a lot of mistakes, and he still gets you men out. But it's still a mistake. And that day, I don't believe I made a mistake in that ball game. And we were getting around to Slaughter. Slaughter didn't play that day. And Slaughter come up to pinch hit in the ninth inning. And DeRocha walked out of the dugout to me, and he says, you know, this fellow can hurt you, don't you? Well, I didn't say anything. I knew he wasn't going to hit me that day. And I threw three fastballs right by him, struck him out, and get out of that game. And I think that's really the best game I ever pitched in my life. You go ahead and get
pardon?
You go ahead now and get me started.
Oh, good. Well, that 1941 team was a great team. They won the pennant. That was about the first time, I can't recall the time that the Dodgers had won the pennant. There was such a turnaround in the club with players like you, and I guess Dolph Camilli came over just a couple years before.
Great.
Pete Reeser was new that year. Pee Wee Reese was new on the club. Hadn't Billy Herman just come
over? Got Billy Herman from the Cubs, and I want to tell you, he's the smartest ball player ever saw. Billy Herman. Boy, I don't know, he just figured you out. He figured hitters out. Hitter hit a ball, and I said, gosh, that's through there. He'd be standing right in front of the ball. He just knew how to play hitters. He was great. Signs, he could pick signs off of second base. We got everybody signs that year. We knew what was coming half the time at the plate. And I'll tell you right now, we had a club that could really hit them.
Yeah.
Camilli could really hit if he knew what was coming. Medwick had Medwick, Dixie Walker, and Reeser, of course. Reeser's a good hitter. He hit the ball hard for a little fella, man. He hit the ball hard and run like a deer. I've seen him hit ball back to pitchers, and on one hop, pitcher be a little nonchalant. That thing be beat him out. He's great. And one was a great catcher too. Throw, gosh, he had an arm. He could really throw good.
You started the All-Star game that year, didn't you? 1941. Weren't you the starting pitcher?
Started the All-Star game against Bob Feller.
Your old teammate.
I was with Feller, see.
Right.
I was with him, and I started against him. In fact, I have a picture of him out there on the wall. He signed that day when we started against each other. And he had the most stuff of any pitcher I've ever seen.
Now, by stuff, you mean motion on the ball? Or control?
Hard, fast, and he was mean pitching. I mean, he had a windup. His windup was, I know a hitter had a hard time following the ball, you know. And a curve that absolutely exploded. He started a curve up here and it'd be down here. He had a big curve. And, I really enjoyed playing with him and got a big kick out of starting a game against him that day. Because I think I pitched two or three innings.
Well, yeah. I have down here two, but you might have gone into the third inning. I'm not sure.
I remember Travis I got in a little trouble in one inning. And Travis hitting the double play, and I got out of that inning, and I was all right. And that was me. I believe that Williams hit a home run off of somebody. Paso.
Paso, right.
In the ninth inning. We hadn't beat that. I think he hit the ball out of the ballpark.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
That's quite a hit.
Yeah.
Well, you lost the series in 1941. The Dodgers lost the series in 41.
Yeah.
Then they had an even better season in 1942 and came in second.
And fooled around and lost it. We had a meeting at McPhail, and he told us that if you don't change your way or don't do better, you're not going to win it.
Do you think the team was complacent?
I kind of believe we were, really.
And Pete Reeser's injury didn't help either.
No, that hurt, yeah. We just fooled around and didn't do it. Looked like we played pretty good ball, but just we just managed to get beat.
I know there was one point where you folks won 6 or 7 games in a row and lost ground.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Because the Cards won 8 or 9 games in the same period. I think those
Cardinals were hitting, boy, they battled you now.
That last 6 weeks, I think they were 43-8. Won 43 and lost 8 games. Hard to beat that.
Some of the names are coming to me now. Crespi, he played with them that year.
Did a lot of Dodgers go into the service? In 1942 and 1943, did you lose a lot of players to the war?
I don't believe we lost too many players. Now, I went up myself and called McPhail or DeRocher and told him that I had been put into a different,
classification?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he says, well, says you just, well, come on up here. He says, if you're going to go, you can go as good from here. Up there, and which he was right. And I went on, and they reclassified me because of the farm. I was raising a lot of wheat, cotton, corn on this farm that I had now. I had about 14 acres here, 1,400 acres at one time. And that farm what kept me out of the service.
That very well could be.
Yeah.
What changes were there on the club when Branch Rickey came on the scene, when he became general manager? How did that seem to affect things?
Well, really, I don't recall. I don't believe he made that many changes, though.
Okay. Were there any
changes? We just kind of played out.
Uh-huh. What about when Walter O'Malley bought the club? Were there any changes that had occurred? How did it affect you when O'Malley bought the club?
Well, it didn't affect me at all. Now, what year was that?
44, I believe.
See, I was before, yeah.
That was your last year.
That's 44, yeah. It was my last year. Then I went to, Simmons got the job over at, Fitzsimmons got the job over Philadelphia managing, and I went over and pitched for him, but I had a bad, real bad year. My arm was bad all year. I remember going to Louisville to a doctor, and he took a red hot iron and burnt my arm, seared it. I told somebody about that the other day. I thought, well, that's a heck of a way to cure an arm, but if a doctor thought it happened, why, okay, but it didn't happen.
Now, you retired after the 1945 season,
right.
Is that right? And refresh my memory. We talked about this on the phone. After the 1945 season, you came back to Georgia. Is that right?
I came back to the farm. Went to farming. Thought I could make a living farming, and I found out I couldn't do it. And I piddled around on the farm and raised a lot of stuff, but it's hard to make money on the farm. And I finally I had a friend of mine, raised close to him. We are not related and have the same name, Knox White. And he was selling insurance for Franklin Life Insurance Company. And he came down, and I went with him, and he says, I'll just pay you to go with me. You just go around and introduce me to the people you know, and I'll just give you so much money for doing that. And that's what I did for about 2 or 3 years. I did fairly good. He begged me to stay with him, but I didn't. After I got a chance to get back, we're sitting out there on the porch out there. And Dixie Walker came by in 19 and came by, and we were real good friends on the Dodgers. And he says, Buddy, says, that's what he always called me, says, Buddy, says, I think I'm going to get the job over in Atlanta this year or this afternoon. And says, I've always thought about you being my pitching coach. And says, would you want to get back in baseball? Oh, gosh, I'm thrilled to death to get back in baseball. And I says, I sure will. So he called me back about 4 o'clock that afternoon. And he says, Buddy, you got a job.
Oh, great.
And that started me back into baseball. So I stayed with them. 1951 Independent. Eddie Matthews was with us that year, and he had a real good year.
If you talk, you can't have any candy.
They're not eating with these teeth I've got. So, I coached that year, first base for him, and was pitching coach. And 1951, I coached in Atlanta. 1952, they made.